Welcome to the More Perfect Union, about the joy we get from American politics. Visit us at moreperfectpodcast.com or go to our Facebook page, More Perfect Union Podcast, and don't forget to rate and review us on iTunes. Hi, I'm DJ from Suffolk, Virginia, a cost estimator and economics instructor, self-described economic conservative, and self-confessed Republican.
I'm Greg. I'm from Cincinnati, Ohio. I'll be your liberal Democrat tonight.
I'm Jonah, an independent from Frederick, Maryland.
And I'm Kevin in Los Angeles, and I'm a Democrat, but I lean slightly more toward the conservative side.
And so for this week, we begin with two leading presidential candidates, Hillary Clinton, the leader on the Democratic side, and Marco Rubio, who, depending upon your polling, is either third or fourth on the Republican side, who both presented their opinions on how to defeat Daesh, otherwise known as the Islamic State. And I don't know about the three of you, but what struck me in reading the speeches, I didn't hear Clinton's speech directly, but I read the transcript of it and I read Rubio's column in Politico, was really how similar they were. They both talked about creating no-fly zones. I'm curious to see how they're going to do that with Russia involved. They both talked about the need to deal with Bashar Assad and how much of a problem he was causing in Syria. And they both talked about bringing in an American military presence. I think Mrs. Clinton wanted it a little smaller than Mr. Rubio, perhaps. But they both talked about bringing in some sort of American military presence to, at the very least, create a place in Syria where folks could get out from under Daesh and Assad and perhaps help to rebuild their country. And it tells me that at least on this issue, although there's a lot of heat going around back and forth, that for the most part, there's a general agreement about what to do in the Middle East, or in particularly in Syria, about how to deal with Assad and Daesh.
Well, sure. I mean, after what happened in Paris, which I haven't heard anyone say, like, oh, well, let's just forget about them. I mean, you know, oh, okay, well, that's done. It's pretty much universally agreed something has to be done, and these are the steps that need to be taken. And Clinton is by far has the, you know, international chops, and Rubio on the GOP, he's the guy who has the chops on that side, and of course they're going to agree. I mean, it makes the most sense that they're going to have the same thing. If you had told me Clinton and Trump have the same plan, then all of a sudden I'd say, what universe am I in?
But how can the guy who, you know, represents the future, the 21st century, and the woman who represents the past, the 20th century, heaven forbid she actually remembers the 1960s, how can they have the same exact foreign policy if they're supposedly so different from each other?
I mean, the situation there is such a mess, you know, that I think a lot of it is what we're seeing is the sort of common sense, common ground stuff that most everybody can agree on. And then everything else, I'm guessing, is just going to be responding to the crazy thing of the day. And then hopefully, you know, the key component there is going to be time. It's, you know, whatever the strategy is, whatever the tactics are, we just need some sort of duration and international coalition to get it together, right? I mean, we can all sort of agree, like you guys are saying, we need to be there. We need to do a thing. I'm the only thing I'm skeptical on is the no-fly zone, just because, you know, how many airplanes do they have? But, you know, other than that, it's sort of like the where you start, right? It's just the base.
Here's my take on it. Assuming that ISIS is still an existential threat, you know, in November, a year from now, which they will be. This election, in many ways, it's going to come down to how many people are you willing to send, you know, boots on the ground, whatever you want to call them. How many troops are you willing to invest in this cause? Everybody is avoiding it, dancing around it. Look, we all know there's going to be some U.S. presence there. We all know it's probably not going to be 100,000 unless, you know, Donald Trump gets elected or somebody crazy like him. But at some point, these people are going to have to actually outline what they're willing to invest in terms of our resources and in terms of our treasure, our blood. And frankly, you know, I think Rubio is going to be the more hawkish candidate. And I think, again, if he gets the nomination and he's up against Hillary Clinton, who is, you know, compared to Bernie Sanders, she's more hawkish. But I think the Democrat will be perceived as being the least or the less likely to get us bogged down, mired in another Iraq. And I just think ultimately that is going to play to that candidate's favor.
Well, that depends, I think, also on how the situation is perceived in November of 2016.
True.
Again, you know, no one is saying put in 100,000 troops or a massive military occupying force. Because frankly, if they did, I would feel much happier, because I'm one of the very few people who thinks that that really is what is warranted right now. But the question is then going to be what will probably fall back upon is comparing the two plans, because you're right, they are relatively vague right now. They will have to flesh it out more, both Clinton and whomever the Republican nominee is. And then at that point, it will become which plan seems more logical, which one seems better. And then we'll be looking at the records of both the candidates. Mrs. Clinton's record as Secretary of State, and she's somewhat fortunate in that a lot of this administration's genuinely big blunders in Syria were under John Kerry's watch and not hers. And then whomever the Republican nominee is, the things that they have said about Syria, what votes they have cast, what statements they have made, are going to be compared against that. And I would say yes, that Clinton probably has an advantage, but not for the reason that Kevin gave. I think Clinton has an advantage because, again, a lot of the really bad foul-ups that have happened on Syria did not happen on her watch. She was gone from the State Department when all that happened.
Yeah, good points.
Well, I mean, lucky her.
So we go from the reasonable to the thoroughly unreasonable. Donald Trump on Thursday hinted, and then I think he confirmed over the weekend, that yes, he really would like a gigantic database on every Muslim in America, refugee, landed immigrant, or citizen. He wants every mosque surveyed, and he said something about creating a special ID for Muslims. And I would laugh if it wasn't so ridiculous, and it is so ridiculous that I still have to chuckle anyway. And while that was all going on, Ben Carson actually sounded – well, no, he didn't sound reasonable by comparison, because it was unreasonable. He referred to the refugees as dogs. And I am beginning to wonder, and this is particularly something because I am a Republican, this is my party, and I'm watching this all right in front of me in my own political home. At what point do my voters look at this and go, okay, this really is not going to fly anymore? Trump is bombastic. Yes, he says some things, but this has to stop.
So okay, what was it after? It was after these comments that Trump went back to winning in the polls, right? Or was it? It was just before, just after, when he took the lead back from Carson, right?
I don't think there's been any polls since then, has he?
There was a poll this weekend, a CNN poll. Yeah. And
there were polls. Polls over the weekend. There were polls over the weekend, but here's the thing. The question was, did Trump take the lead after he said this stuff? And I think it was after, but for the most part, Trump took the lead by standing still. It was Carson who fell back. It was not – Trump did not make any gains. Carson had overtaken him, and then Carson fell back. Carson falling back is – I think I would say it's a healthy sign, because his vote did not go to Trump. It went to one of the more established and experienced candidates. But Trump didn't actually gain. His position pretty much hardened, and that was a benefit to him because Carson fell back. But again, the question is really going to be, it may be that Carson is going to continue to fall, but at what point do Trump's voters see through the shtick? I grew up in New Jersey. I've seen this all before. I know how Donald Trump operates. You know, folks in the other 49 states, I guess, haven't. And it's really starting to bother me.
Okay, go ahead, Greg.
Yeah, so, you know, at what point, I mean, it's a lot of fear-mongering, you know, and it's not like we haven't seen this from the GOP before. And I don't want to say that, like, oh, you guys are so terrible. But he's playing to a base, and he only, right now he's at, what, 25%? And because there's so many, he's like, okay, this is the worst thing that could happen. And so I'm going to say just the worst thing. And I'm going to use fear, fear, fear. And people are buying it. You know, that's kind of his shtick. You know, let's rile up and let me say just the worst, absolute worst thing. And I'll be declared honest because I can say these terrible things. And if you say anything against me, well, it's just because I'm not politically correct. I mean, it's amazing, you know.
Greg, are you declaring Trump the Carlos Mencia of American politics?
Oh, my God! Yes! Yes, I guess that would make Rubio like the Dane Cook. Not very funny or smart, but still up there. Oh, my gosh. But yes, that's it! He is! I'm going... You get credit for that one.
Well, I will have to say about the only thing of if in fact Carson is falling back, which is what the polls are showing, then it may very well be that rather than, you know, that this, I mean, obviously there are a lot of people in the Republican Party who want an outsider. But if Carson is falling back, then it may not be Trump and Carson voters versus everyone else in the party as much as it is just Trump voters versus everyone else in the party. And if that's the case, and we'll have to see if more polls bear this out, this may be just a weekend blip. But if it's not a weekend blip and Carson really is falling back, then I think it will be relatively easier for the rest of the party to come in. To come in behind someone who would then be able to defeat Trump. I mean, at this point, most of the polling shows that the only candidates who are even in double digits right now are Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz. So I could very well see a situation. Initially, I was thinking that coming out of New Hampshire, it was probably going to be Cruz, Rubio, Trump, and Carson, not necessarily in that order, but that they would be the four who would come out of New Hampshire, definitely come out of South Carolina. It may very well be that Carson is not one of those survivors. It may very well come down to Trump, Cruz, and Rubio, in which case I would probably say that, and granted he's my guy, I would say that Rubio probably has an advantage in part because Trump and Cruz are still somewhat trying to fishing from the same stream. And in a lot of cases, Republican primary delegates are awarded by a congressional district in a winner-take-all process. And every congressional district has three delegates. So a whole bunch of districts in, say, Kevin's home city of Los Angeles, who haven't sent a Republican to Congress in 50 years, still send three delegates each to the convention. And it could very well be that Rubio sweeps those kind of districts and districts outside of the South or outside of the rural Rockies and use that to go through and to win the nomination. But we'll have to see. But it's if Carson falls back, then he may not come out of Iowa and New Hampshire in that case. Mm-hmm. Or Carson falls back, excuse me.
Right.
So I'd like to talk about the refugee idea for a second. I've been thinking about this a bit, and the idea that now we have the situation where there are a number of governors that don't want any refugees. And it's based around this idea that some of the terrorists are going to sneak into this country as refugees and then blow stuff up. So I read this article in Washington Post. I don't know if anybody else has seen this yet, but one of the things that people are pointing to, the anti-refugee people are pointing to the idea that there was one of the Paris bombers was a migrant who came in to Greece with a fake passport. And so they're saying that, well, this is another good reason why we shouldn't have, you know, refugees and things. But what this article
– but I'll get into that later.
Yeah. What this article points out is saying that the situation is very different in that in Europe, those are asylum seekers and they're classified differently than refugees are classified in America, which is a much more stringent process. And what it points out is that there are so many loopholes in our laws, in the United States laws about visas and people that are on tourist visas and whatever, that it's actually much easier for someone with faked information to come in with a visa than it is for them to get in line and be processed as a refugee. And I guess I'm just sort of wondering what everybody's take on this anti-refugee sentiment is. Like, what have you guys been thinking about? What have you been hearing?
So
I'll let Kevin and Greg get on the pedestal before I answer, because I don't.
It's
I think
a big pedestal. It's a big soapbox.
That's okay. And you huge. Go ahead. Go.
It's like tied and all. I mean, it's a huge. Kevin, why don't you go first?
Well, no, actually, you go first, because I may surprise you guys.
Oh no, I could be alone. Okay,
I may make a big friend in DJ today.
Oh. Okay, so
no, you won't. But go on.
Yeah, you know, it's just amazing that so and bear with me. Trump the other day said, "I saw thousands of people clap as the Trade Center fall." Right, and he just said that, but there was no proof, and he just says these ridiculous things that there's no accountability for. Right. And these governors now are saying these things like, well, I'm just not going to let this happen. But they can't stop it, you know, and there's no accountability. Like, well, you know what, tomorrow I'm not going to let the sun rise because I've noticed that UV skin cancer is just so terrible. And I am going to protect you, fair people, because fear. Well, you know what? Republican governors of these 14, 15 states, you know, too bad. It's not how it works. You can't stop it. You don't have the authority. You don't have these powers. And it's nice that you guys can say these things to firm up your base and to, you know, bring up all these fears in everybody that under their bed may be a refugee who's ready to, you know, steal their jobs or take away their Medicaid or what was it? Take away the benefits from all the homeless vets that they were so concerned about the day before. Oh, wait, they weren't. But, you know, the governors are just talking out of their asses. So, you know, we can talk about whether they should bring them in or shouldn't. But right now, the governors don't have anything. They're just blustering. So it's a lot of bullshit. And, I'll beep that out later. But, you know, it's bullshit. So,
okay, get off the box. I'm climbing on. So, here's my thing. You know, when this first broke earlier in the week, yes, my sort of liberal, you know, love them all tendencies were there. And, you know, I've always felt that America should be open to anyone who needs asylum and who is, you know, being oppressed and blah, blah, blah.
Amen.
But as I thought about this issue during the week, and I realized, you know, everything has a political component. It's not just about laws. Why are people laughing while I'm talking?
Nothing. I'm shocked. I was just going to say, stop at that amen that I just said.
Yeah, but there's an addendum to it. There's a big but, and I'm sitting on it. There's a political component to this. You know, for me personally, I would have no problem if we brought 65,000 of these people into the country. I wouldn't be at the airport trying to block them from getting off the plane. I don't mind if they, you know, are living in my town. But from a political point of view, I started to think about this, and it occurred to me, look, these refugees need help. There's about, I think, 2 million of them. Flooded into nations and cities in Europe and those places can no longer, you know, take anymore. But instead of flying 65,000 people to the United States and going through a year-long process of trying to vet them – of course, we would vet them before we brought them – and going through a year-long process of trying to vet them, all of the resources that it would take – and then finding some way to assimilate them into our culture. Wouldn't it make better sense if we found more appropriate places for them in Europe or in, you know, whether it's Northern Africa or in the Muslim countries in the Middle East. Why bring them here? And again, I'm not saying, oh, I don't want them here. I think they're going to kill people. It's more like, why do it when there are other options that probably make more sense? And one other thing I want to add, which again is going to, you know, I say every week I'm a Democrat, but I lean slightly conservative, and I don't think people believe it until I start explaining why. But, you know, I think it was Mike Huckabee this week who said, well, we should just take in the Christian refugees and not the Muslim. which again, you know, when you say just or, you know, only – It goes into, you know, la-la land. But, you know, if we were to decide that we're going to bring 60,000 refugees to the United States, and let's say 20,000 of them were Yazidi, I think that's pronunciation, Christians who have been, you know, thrown out of their homeland, why not bring 20,000 Christians to the United States and then the other 40,000 could be Muslim? It makes perfect sense to me. It's sort of like what we talked about in busing in the 70s. Why send Christians into Saudi Arabia and bring 60,000 Muslims here? Now, if I'm being racist, I totally apologize. I'm just saying what I feel and I'm trying not to be racist about it. So with that, DJ, the soapbox, or Jonah, the soapbox is yours.
Can I interrupt? Huckabee is a horrible human being. That's I don't think anyone's going to argue. That's not going to like open up like a dialogue.
I agree with
you. Okay.
But he has such homey mannerisms.
homey mannerisms. That's about the one nice thing you can say about Mike Huckabee. If I may.
Yes, please.
This entire discussion centers around a complete and utter lack of imagination and clear thinking here.
Well, that's what we do.
We're talking about. Yeah, I understand that. No, I'm not talking about. I'm not talking about the four of us. It's the rest of the country. The first thing that this is all is that the European Union is a complete disaster that can never be a country.
Amen.
You have 30 nations that don't talk to each other about sharing information, so that they don't even tell each other when they have their own list of people who might be problematic, who might be terrorists, but they don't share the list with each other. So it's essentially a country says, ooh, this person is a problem. Oh, they left our country. They went somewhere else. Okay, that's just fine. We're all good. No, that's not the way this is supposed to work. The second thing, and this really bugs me, we have an opportunity here. We have an opportunity to build a Syrian diaspora that can help us reach back into that country and help build a third force that is neither Daesh nor Assad. We can do that with either working to find people who would be willing to go back in a military force, people who would be willing to do information propaganda, people who would be willing to establish networks, people who might be willing to help us improve our screening of the refugees that come in behind them. This is something that Churchill did for World War II for just about every occupied government from the Nazis. He let them set up governments in exile. He found people among them who'd be willing to form resistance cells back home. They created a special operations executive just for this purpose. Why aren't we thinking like that? Why aren't we saying, you know something, this is a war and these people can be assets if they wish to. Why don't we seize that opportunity? This is something where fear has completely clouded us to the rational thinking plan that can help us win this war. And it's an opportunity we should seize and that we should not be afraid to seize.
Do you think maybe we are doing that, but we're just not
100% clear what you're suggesting, DJ.
Say that again?
I'm not 100% clear what you're proposing. Could you be more specific?
Oh. What I'm proposing is let these refugees in, as many of them as we can take. I mean, it takes them a year and a half to 2 years to get through this process anyway.
Right.
If Europe is any if the way Europe has treated them and the way Europe treats each other are any indication, they'd be much better here than there to begin with. And then for those who come in here, I am sure there are many who would be willing to help take their country back in however way they can do it. They just can't because right now they're in a pincer movement with Assad on one side and Daesh on the other. Let them – if they can't build that – if they cannot build that force, that third force over there – and admittedly, that's hard to do given this situation. We can help them begin to build it here.
So then we bring 65,000 in the first year and probably another 65,000 in the second year, of course. And those years are delayed because of the process. And you're saying then we take the able-bodied men in the right age category and try to cajole them into joining a force that we would train here and then send back there to fight? Is that the idea?
That might be one of the things we can do. If they're not willing to do that, and not everyone has to fight for their country by picking up a gun.
Right.
They can pick up a microphone. They can pick up a computer. There are many things that they can do. And I am sure there are many of them who would like to do it if they thought there was a possibility. We need to see what we can do to make that possibility happen here. And that is far better, I think, than slamming the door, because it's a useless door, because Canada's going to take 10,000 by the end of the year anyway. So unless we're militarizing the border with Canada, the refugee risk that is supposedly existing is going to exist whether we shut the door or not, because the countries around us won't.
Right.
So let's embrace that. Let's embrace the opportunity. That's what I say.
And that's an area of the world. So even if none of these people want to fight, you know, this is an area of the world where we could do with a little more goodwill, and we could make people like us better by not being asses all the time. You know, and just like letting, I think part of the issue is that maybe a lot of folks hear the idea of refugee and they think illegal immigrant, and maybe that's just something in the air. But for me, people trying to escape a war are different than, you know, people trying to sneak across. These are people that are in line and waiting, you know, just for an area to be safe with their family for a while. And I think that maybe part of the issue that some people are having, maybe these governors or whatever, is they're just thinking like, well, we know what those Mexicans are trying to do to us, and these guys are even worse than the Mexicans. I don't know. I wonder if it's just like anybody coming to this country with an accent is sort of colored with the same brush.
Well, what would their status be?
Nice pun there, Jonah.
Yes.
by the way, I should note that according to the Pew Research Group, net migration from Mexico has gone negative over the last few years. More people now go back to Mexico than come here. Go ahead, Kevin, ask your question.
So my question is, what would the refugees' status be here? They wouldn't be coming on visas. And they're not going to become American citizens overnight. What would their status be?
They'd be settled refugees, I believe. Jonah, you actually read the story, so you go ahead and answer.
Yeah, I think this is what George Takei was sort of like upset about, like that it's more akin to, here is your new neighborhood. You know, here is your – I don't want to say camps, because I don't know that that's necessarily accurate. But I think I don't think it's like, you're in, you're not a threat, have at it, and like the country is open to you. I think there's still a lot of monitoring, and that in theory, when the crisis is over, they would be highly encouraged. I don't know if required is accurate, but highly encouraged to now return. So
what
it's
would their working status be?
I don't think that's accurate. I think if, as I read it, once they are considered settled refugees, they do have freedom to go wherever they want about the country. But it takes 18 to 24 months to become a settled refugee.
It's
a long process. So, but you know, once they become a settled refugee, then they have, you know, they have free reign of the country, and they do have the opportunity. I believe they have the opportunity to apply for citizenship. And frankly, that is not an opportunity that I want to deny them. So they would just be settled refugees. But Jonah, you mentioned something in the very beginning that we haven't really talked about, and that is the biggest issue that we have in immigration policy. It's not the border with Mexico. It's not a refugee situation. It's visa jumping. People who come here on visas and don't leave. That is the biggest source of unauthorized immigration. That is the biggest gap in our immigration policy enactment and enforcement, and it is also the one thing that nobody seems to talk about.
Well, actually, they talked about it. They talked about it on Meet the Press this morning, and they also pointed out, and they are agreeing with you, by the way, and they also pointed out it is the largest gap in our security efforts, that more terrorists have come into this country on those visa programs than have ever snuck into the country.
Okay, well then I am glad that other people are mentioning it now, because that is, if we really want to crack this nut, that's the first thing we have to look at. We have to look at finding a way of tightening our visa system and finding a better way of – and if there's – I mean, we normally do not like governments monitoring anything in this country. That's half the reason that we're Americans. But at the same time, you know, folks who are here on ostensibly temporary visas, I can understand certainly why – I can understand the rationale that governments would want to keep a closer eye on them because they are supposed to be here temporarily. Now, I'm not going to give them up with a simplistic answer because I don't have one, but I do know it is something that we have to address, and I am glad it is being discussed more now.
Thank God for Chuck Todd.
Cool.
Chuck Todd.
The answer to all our problems.
Yes. Now, while all this was going on, Louisiana had the runoff to their governor's race on Saturday. And what was a surprise to everybody who doesn't know the trials and travails of David Vitter, David Vitter actually lost to a Democrat. I know nothing about the Democrat myself except his name, John Bel Edwards. Hmm. Interesting name, that. John Bel being a Tennessee Whig senator for a while. But I was actually surprised, one, that David Vitter was actually reelected in 2010. After
I was being shocked by that.
After being caught in the whole Madam prostitution ring here in the D.C. area. In fact, that gives you an idea of how much of a drag Barack Obama was on the 2010 ticket for Democrats, when the Democrats couldn't even beat David Vitter that year. But in 2015, things were different. Voters finally had the chance to take it out on David Vitter. Bobby Jindal, the incumbent governor, decided he'd rather run for president than have to try to defend David Vitter. And David Vitter lost. So I'll just throw it open.
We could see this as – and back me up, everyone. Either hoist me on your shoulders or just loud applause. Perhaps we're seeing a turning for the Democratic Party.
I don't think that's it. I think now, correct me if I'm wrong. I think this is the first Democratic governor of Louisiana since Katrina. Is that right?
Yeah, that's definitely correct.
So Katrina really changed around Louisiana. And Edwards is a very different – he's not a New England Democrat. He is not a West Coast Democrat. He is super conservative on most all social issues, right? Like anti-gay marriage, like a lot of stuff like that. But – and if you heard some of those – some of the ads that he was running, they're great. He's also a former Army Ranger, I think. So he's got like military credibility. He comes from a political family. He's super conservative where he needs to be. And I think it's too early to say that there's any sort of groundswell or movement there. I think that Vitter caught up to himself. Some of the ads that Edwards ran were like, what was it? It was a great one. Did you hear this ad? It was a radio ad, and it said like, when there was a vote to honor veterans and he took a call from a prostitute and left and didn't even vote to help veterans because he was going to go meet a prostitute. And it was great. It was a great ad.
I didn't listen to that ad, but I heard of it. And as soon as I knew that ad is in existence, I knew David Vitter was in very, very deep trouble.
Yeah.
I don't want any more ads. I don't want to listen to it. And I love political ads. From now on, I just want you, Jonah, to explain them all to me. Because you do such a better job, and you deal with such emotion with just you screaming, prostitute. Because I think it's so much more fun for you to do it. And I enjoy it so much more. So from now on, I'm going to send all my ads, especially the ones from Ohio. I get a lot, and I just want you to read them over Skype to me. So I'm going to let you know that right now.
Sure.
It's sort of like the fake sneeze where they go, prostitute, excuse me.
I'm pretty sure everyone was doing that around Vitter.
Yeah. Yeah, I kind of wish that I could spend an election season in Louisiana. It just sounds like a crazy state, like to watch all the local machinations going on down there.
I'm sure it was.
Yeah.
Speaking of crazy, and I'm going to segue.
That can be a segue to anything.
I know, but it's and I'm sure I've probably lost listeners on this one. Bernie Sanders.
We're not laughing at him. We're laughing at the segue.
At the segue. Gave his, what is a democratic socialism speech? Because that's a dead horse. He just won't stop kicking.
Bernie Sanders tried to sell himself this week as FDR incarnate. And you know what? FDR is my favorite president of the 20th century. Maybe after Lincoln, my favorite president of all time. Bernie Sanders ain't no FDR.
You knew FDR.
I knew FDR. I knew him well. Yeah. He was a friend of mine.
He's no FDR.
I missed this speech. So why should I consider myself a democratic socialist?
Because you believe that corporations can have too much power, and there's an earnings gap between the wealthy and the not so wealthy, and that we have to put the powerful back in their place. Therefore, everyone who is not a conservative is, by Bernie's definition, a democratic socialist.
Sold. I'm on board. Let's go.
Who had the research recently that said? Most people would rather have like anybody but a socialist as president. In fact, I think it was they would rather have a Muslim refugee as a president.
Oh, really?
I'm almost sure that may be hyperbole.
But that's a little hyperbole. But there was a poll, and they did list several things, and socialists came in like 7th out of 8.
Right. It was like 53% of Americans would not vote for anyone with just the word socialist. I mean.
Right. Sure. And so it was his attempt to neutralize this problem. Unfortunately for Bernie, he did it on the day of the Paris attacks, and it got no traction whatsoever. And frankly, I don't mean to be rude to Bernie Sanders. Whenever you say anything about Bernie Sanders, people say you're criticizing him, you're attacking him. But at this point, frankly, you know, he's down 20 to 25 points in the national polls. He's down 18 to 20 points in Iowa. The next time a New Hampshire poll comes out, I guarantee you he's going to be behind Hillary Clinton. He's tilting at windmills now. And, you know, everyone says, oh, there's plenty of time. Barack Obama was in the same position in 2007 and all this stuff. Yes, look, anything can happen, but Hillary Clinton's going to be the nominee. Anything can happen, but Hillary Clinton is going to be the nominee.
Barack Obama had the opportunity to run a generational campaign against Hillary Clinton. He was younger than she was. He was able to run as the auger of history. I probably used the term auger wrong, but you know what I mean. Bernie Sanders is older than Hillary Clinton, and he isn't bringing in anything about new history. The irony is, if he had said, you know, the only elected official. Out there today who calls himself a socialist, a capital S socialist, as far as I know, is François Hollande, who is the president of France. Monsieur Hollande has been busy fighting Al-Qaeda all over Africa with French troops. He has them in Mali. He has them, I think, supporting the folks in Nigeria. He has a contingent in East Africa, and now he has a contingent in Syria. If Bernie Sanders had said, a socialist is like François Hollande. He kicks Al-Qaeda's ass wherever he finds it. He could have jumped a few points in the polls, I think.
Sure.
But unfortunately for Bernie, when most people think of socialism, they either think the Soviet Union or they think of Great Britain in the late 1970s in the Winter of Discontent. Anybody who remembers either of those examples is not going to be happy with anybody who claims to be a democratic socialist. And frankly, that's because in those versions, even true democratic socialism, which is what the Labour Party tried in Great Britain in the 1970s, it failed spectacularly. And if Bernie really wants people to think about what democratic socialism is, then he has to basically say, yes, I want the government to be able to tell businesses that they can't give you a raise. Because that's what governments in Britain did with pay policies. They told private firms, don't give your people raises. It's too dangerous to inflation. They actually did that back then. I don't think Bernie's going to be able to do very well if people actually remember what democratic socialism actually is And that's why he's not doing well now and why I don't think he's going to do well next year.
Do we have any countries right now that do self-identify as socialists that are doing well? Like, what is Venezuela doing? Like, are they socialist?
Venezuela is running out of foodstuffs and their grocery shelves are empty. It has the highest murder rate in Latin America. I would say it is not doing well myself.
But they do self-identify as Chavez, right?
Chavez, yeah.
Yeah,
Chavez and his successor, they identify as a social democracy. Now, Western Europe has plenty of social democratic parties. And, of course, the Social Democratic Party in France calls itself the Socialist Party. But they usually enact what are called Keynesian policies. But the only thing that is truly socialist in Western Europe probably surrounds health care and maybe a couple of – in some cases I think some energy stuff. But that's really the only part of democratic socialism that still survives. And even that on continental Europe – there's still a very, very large private contingent in healthcare provision and even healthcare insurance in some ways. Genuine socialism of the kind that we would normally think about, government control and ownership of large parts of the economy, even in Europe, that's not as cachet as it used to be.
And in all fairness to Sanders, that's not what he's suggesting. That's not part of his program.
Of course not. Of course not.
Do you think he could have gotten away, like, if, like, 6-7 months ago he said, you know what, I'm not a socialist? Do you think he could have got away with that?
He would have been better positioned.
Sure.
But the problem is that he's on record. He's been elected as a socialist.
I know. But if he put out, like, a Christine O'Donnell, I'm not a witch.
Well, that worked so well for her.
I know.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
You know, like, if he like, a little Russian hat and said, look, I'm not a socialist. I'm a lot of things. Would he have been doing better now? Would he not be 20 points ahead? What do you guys think?
I think if he had – there was actually a very long tradition of anti-communist social democrats in Europe and quite a few in America. If Bernie had seized upon them, Sidney Hook, for example – not Arthur Kessler anymore because he had some issues with women. And some of the folks in Western Europe on the left who call themselves social democrats, Willy Brandt in Germany, François Mitterrand in France, very anti-communist social democrats and anti-communist socialists. Had he sort of harkened back to their tradition, I think he might have been able to square the circle a little bit and be more viable. But I really – the biggest problem is he is older and he is whiter than Hillary Clinton is, and that means he is not going to win.
Yeah. Those are two expletives that are pretty pretty important there.
And by the way, if you're in a position where you have to renounce being a socialist, you're not starting from a position of strength.
It's also true.
It's how I used to have to start every Thanksgiving when I came into my father's house.
And Dad. Speaking of Thanksgiving, and I know that we're really at pushing time here, but I happen to have on the one of the news networks that I don't even know the name of, OAN, and they're reminding us that today, November 22nd, is the anniversary of JFK's assassination.
Oh yeah.
And I know that wasn't on our list of topics for tonight, but I thought maybe we should just end with maybe a memory of where you were if you were old enough to remember it, or
I think
anything
the
that relates
only
to today.
One who's old enough?
I am actually.
So
old
where
enough.
Were you? Out of curiosity.
Thank you for asking. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Kev.
I was 7 years old.
Go ahead, Kev.
For some reason, I was home from school. I was watching television, and the news broke. The news came on and announced this. And my mother and her friends were playing Mahjong in the den. And I went in there and being 7 years old and not really understanding what was going on, and I just knew a couple of buzzwords from news, I went in and these women were playing Mahjong. And I said, Mom, I'm not sure, but I think Khrushchev just shot Kennedy. And they all started laughing at me. And I was going, no, I'm telling you, turn on the TV. And I insisted that my mother turn on the TV while these women were laughing at little Kevin. And then, of course, they saw the news breaking. And what I remember from that day is how quickly that room turned from laughter to tears.
Wow.
My parents.
And I still
both...
think Khrushchev shot him, by the way. Oh, go ahead.
my parents are both 15 years old. They were in their various high schools at the time. They did not know each other. My dad was in Elizabeth, my mother, was in Cranford, and they both remember. They remembered the classroom they were in when they were told that it had happened. They remembered everything that happened afterwards that day. It was really, for them, it was essentially a mortal blow, because Kennedy really represented the can-do spirit of America in a way that we really haven't seen since. He really was the embodiment of the optimism of the post-war generation, having been passed on from the generation that led the war to the generation that fought the war. And that was suddenly snuffed out in a flash. And nothing against Lyndon Johnson. Lyndon Johnson was a very shrewd political operator. He was a fantastic legislator. But he was just – his talents were not the right talents for a chief executive. And it essentially meant – that Kennedy's assassination was the end of an era. It was the end of an era of optimism. It was an end of an era of national unity. The fact that so many people mourned him, so many people who voted against him still mourned him, says something about that period of time that I don't think we could recreate today, and we may not have ever been able to recreate from the day he died.
Well said.
Well said. All right. I hate to leave on that sad note.
Well, it is old. It's 55 years ago. Who cares?
Yeah, I was going to say. I've moved on. Before we leave, like always, how are you guys feeling about the races? Who do you think? We just had Jindal drop out. We mentioned that earlier. Out of curiosity, who do you think's going to leave? Going around the table, who do you think's next out in the GOP?
Boy, it's so hard. I'm going to say Santorum or Huckabee. I have no idea.
Yeah, probably one of the guys who's not actually in the debates anymore. It might be Pataki. It might be, what's his name, Gilmore.
Oh,
I don't know.
I forgot about Gilmore.
And then what's it? I don't know. I think it's one of those guys. I think it's one of those two, probably.
I will say it's probably Pataki. He's going to be the next to go. I think his money will run out soon.
I'm hoping Huckabee. I would just my I nothing would make me happier than Huckabee.
I think he's so shrewd, though. Like, in his own way, I think that he'll wait until to drop out, so he can time it when he can gain something. You know, yeah. Well, like, somebody will start winning and he'll drop out and endorse them, even though he's at like 2% or something.
Yeah, but he's not going for a vice presidency.
No, but he's going for himself.
Yeah, I can't see what is Kasich's right in the middle, and he did get a little bump recently, but he's not going to win and he's not going to get vice president. Is he looking for second?
Kasich and Bush are hoping on strong showings from New Hampshire. If Kasich doesn't get a strong showing in New Hampshire, then he will be out. If Bush doesn't get a strong showing in New Hampshire, he will probably be convinced to get out. That's what I think. Just about everyone, except for Cruz, Rubio, Carson, and Trump, everyone is either betting on Iowa or New Hampshire to save them. And I think they're all going to miss their bets, and they're all going to be gone by the time South Carolina comes around.
I hope so.
And whose name never comes up anymore? Carly Fiorina.
Ah. Thank you.
She's fallen off the map.
She's horrible.
Yeah, she'll be gone too by New Hampshire.
She's out with the Sixth Fleet.
Yeah.
Rebuilding it from underwater.
And with that, I think we can end on a high note.
Yay. All right. Well, it's been wonderful talking to you guys. Like always, we'll see you guys next week then.
Have a great Thanksgiving. We'll
see you then. Good Thanksgiving to everyone.